I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times. President Trump is not happy about Michael Wolff's book, Fire and Fury, and tweeted on Saturday that the book is a fake and the author is deranged who knowingly writes false information. He added, "The mainstream media is crazed that we won the election." You cannot buy that kind of publicity. Wolff's book has quickly become a bestseller. It's about the first 7 or 8 months of the Trump White House, described as chaotic, with turf wars and an inner circle over their head and at each other's throats. The portrait of the president is of a man essentially unfit for the job. Now, Wolff has had his share of critics who question his approach to reporting. We asked Michael Wolff to join us on Radio Times to talk about all of us, and he joins us from the studios of NPR in New York City. Michael Wolff, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Nice to be here.
President Trump tweeted, "He has never spoken to you. You were not granted access to the White House. I know you have been asked this before, but you don't just get inside the White House unless you have some kind of invitation or an invitation to an interview. Who gave you the green light to get inside the White House?"
The President of the United States.
How did he do that?
I asked. He agreed.
So you said, "Sir, I would like to interview you, and I would like to come and be a bit of a fly on the wall in the White House and get a sense of your first months in office?"
I said, "Yes, I would like to come and observe what goes on in the White House." And he thought I was asking for a job. I said, no, I was not asking for a job, that I wanted to write a book. And he was immediately deflated by that answer because he was uninterested in a book. And then he proposed that another author who he knew, Ed Klein, that he might write a book. And I said, "Well, there are room for several books." And he effectively said, "Go knock yourself out." That's how I got in.
Did the president know you were interviewing him when you thought you were interviewing him, because he says he never had an interview with you?
I have no idea what he thought.
But would you say, I mean, I'm just trying to get inside your head and get inside the White House. Would you say, "Sir, I'd like to sit down and have an interview with you and talk about X, Y, and Z"?
Well, the curious thing about talking to Donald Trump is that you don't get to say anything. He just talks to you. I don't know. I mean, this whole idea about my reporting method, right, seems bewildering. He's the President of the United States. You speak to the President of the United States, that's newsworthy.
You describe being on this couch in the West Wing as a kind of constant interloper. Where's this couch? Were you sitting there pretty much all day long watching people come and go, overhearing conversations?
Yeah, the couch is in the reception area. There are actually two couches, so sometimes I would sit on one couch, and then to shake things up, I would move to another couch. Yes, I mean, you sat there, you passed in the morning because you had an appointment with somebody, and the people in the Trump White House invariably did not keep their appointments, so you sat there and waited and waited. Eventually, over all this time, you got to know everyone, so you became a sort of not unpleasant fixture, and people would sit down and speak or invite you back, and it was a kind of a rolling conversation throughout the West Wing.
And did you have a notebook so people saw you taking notes? Do you work that way?
I sometimes do, sometimes not, but I have written in my long career many millions of words. I think people knew who I was and what I was.
I want to get to the president, obviously, your book, but I do need to get to some of the people who have criticized you. And one is Vanity Fair reporter Gabriel Sherman. He wrote a book about Steve Bannon, and Steve Bannon's very much featured in your book as well.
No, he wrote a book about Roger Ailes.
Oh, I'm sorry, Roger Ailes, absolutely. But he says here, for more than a year, and you wrote, and Roger Ailes appears in this as well. He writes, for more than a year, Wolff viciously attacked journalists, fueling public distrust in the news media in service of buttering up his Trump sources. So basically, Wolff's approach was to lie in service of getting the truth. What do you say in response to that?
Well, I have no response. Gabe Sherman and I don't like each other. I've written terrible things about him, so I suppose I'm getting my due back. I dare say that that it seems to say that I've destroyed trust in the news media. I think there are other people on ahead of me on that line. I got the story. I was the one. I did it. I'm proud of myself. And I think I've written a good book. So I'm very comfortable with the way things have turned out.
I'm sure you are. I wonder, though, whether your approach to writing this book does raise questions about how reporters cover a president or a person like Donald
Trump.
Let me
stop you there. This is the White House. Everyone, we have a right to know what's going on. This is the job this is the job of journalists. Find out what's going on in the White House. It's the paramount job of a journalist. And I seem to have succeeded to some degree where others have not. And let's be more generous about this, there's a lot of good reporters who are doing a lot of good work, but there are different ways to skin a cat. And there's going to be a lot of approaches to understanding this White House, the story of our time. Now, I think these accusations, I suppose, of duplicitousness, I came into the White House. Whose work is easily available. Anyone could have found out who I am, what I do. Obviously somebody had to allow me into the White House. You cannot just walk into the White House. So therefore, I would say the responsibility in this instance of who I am and what I want falls more on the White House side than my side. As for me, what did I say to them? I said literally, I want to go see what's going on. Mm. I want to write a book. I want to write a book from your point of view. That was probably the only editorial advice that I gave them regarding what I wanted to do. From your point of view, from the point of view of people in the White House, which is, by the way, exactly what I've done.
You describe a president who doesn't read, who doesn't listen, who thinks he knows more than anyone else, who has a very short attention span, who relies on his gut, is overconfident, is insecure, is paralyzed. I could go on and on and on and on. How do you describe? I mean, in many ways, the book is about the president. It's also about Steve Bannon and others. But how do you describe our president?
Well, I think that is how I describe the president. That's, you just were quoting me.
But do you see him as unfit?
Literally, you just went through and characterized what I said in the book. So that is, yes, that's but let me make a finer point here,
sure.
Which is that this book is not really about what I think of the president. I think that's irrelevant. What it is about is what the people around him think of him, and all of those things, as you just listed, are exactly what the people around him think of him.
And you say 100% believing that he really is essentially unfit for the job.
100% of the senior staff, yes.
When you say senior staff, does that include Ivanka and Jared, his family? Do they see him that way?
Yes, in fact. And that's why they're there.
Ivanka sees her father that way?
And that's why, as someone remarked about the Trump kids, they have great tolerance for him but no illusions about him.
Did you speak to any cabinet members?
I won't tell you who I spoke to in this book. I've spoken to a deep bench of people around the president.
I think about 200 people. Do I have that right?
Yes.
Did you speak to the vice president?
I have a full range of agreements with the people that I spoke to. So if it's in the book, If it's on the record, if those things are on the record, they are in the book. Otherwise, I've promised people on pain of all kinds of things that I would never reveal that I spoke to them.
What kinds of things? Just curious.
There are a set of promises that I've made that even if people were asked if they spoke to me, they could deny it, and I have promised that I would not then say, no, that's wrong. I spoke to that person.
You do have tapes, though, my understanding is.
I do indeed.
And you have tapes of everything?
I only have tapes of what I taped.
Well, I didn't know how much taping you were actually doing.
Well, yeah, you know, I work like all reporters. Sometimes when you can tape, you tape. Other times when you can't, you don't. Sometimes I take notes. Sometimes these are just conversations in which afterwards I run into a bathroom somewhere and get it all down.
Let me ask you about Jared Kushner. He's the president's son-in-law, and I Googled this just to make sure I have it right. These are the responsibilities he has been given: to negotiate the Middle East peace, to solve the opioid crisis, to deal with Mexican and Chinese diplomacy, to reform healthcare for veterans, to reform the criminal justice system, and to reinvent government. Why does the president view his son-in-law as someone who can solve all these problems?
I have no idea.
That would be
the mystery, one of the mysteries at the center of this White House, and a source of the great resentment within the White House, not only resentment but confusion and perplexity. And it obviously makes no sense. Jared Kushner is a young man, relatively inexperienced in every business. His he inherited a large amount of money from his father. He has been active in the family's real estate company, but to my knowledge, no other businesses outside of his family's business. He is, I think, what we used to call a socialite.
Oh, and a very, I guess, New York socialite at that.
Yes. Oh, he owned a weekly newspaper in New York, which he ran into the ground. But I think that is pretty much his resume.
Well, let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. Michael Wolff is our guest. You've probably heard of his book. It's called Fire and Fury Inside the Trump White House. And you can send us an email comment, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times to join our conversation. Much more to talk about after this very short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane talking with Michael Wolff about his new book, bestseller now, called Fire and Fury Inside the Trump White House. Michael, I do want to play a clip, and this is President Trump. He was speaking to reporters at a cabinet meeting last week about the country's current libel laws.
We are going to take a strong look at our country's libel laws, so that when somebody says something that is false and defamatory about someone, that person will have meaningful recourse in our courts. Our current libel laws are a sham and a disgrace and do not represent American values or American fairness. So we're going to take a strong look at that. We want fairness. You can't say things that are false, knowingly false, and be able to smile as money pours into your bank account.
Michael, that seems to be aimed at you. Any response?
It does indeed seem to be aimed at me.
Does it make you more nervous?
It does. It does not. It's just more Donald Trump know-nothing ridiculousness. I mean, he can't. The libel laws happen to be one of the things supported by both the left and by Democrats and Republicans. Many occur on the state level. It's extraordinary. The man just has no idea what he's talking about, almost ever.
Almost ever. Help us understand the businessman in New York before he became president. How was Donald Trump viewed by the hoi polloi, if I can use that very kind of dated word there, just people within the real estate business, the wealthy people that are so much a part of the New York scene? How did they see Donald Trump?
Not to correct you, but the hoi polloi is the other side. The hoi polloi are the normal, the common people.
Oh, goodness. Thank you.
His circle of the real estate rich, the real estate billionaires and others, he was regarded as sort of an amusement. No one certainly took him seriously as a businessman, as a real estate developer, as a figure of any consequence. He was just a showman, a salesman. You know, his basic reason for being was to sell a $1 million condo for $1.1 million. That's what he did, and he promoted himself relentlessly. Many people liked him. No one trusted him, but many people liked him. Steve Bannon, I think, refers to him. I quote Steve in the book as saying he was a big, warm-hearted monkey. and I think that is basically who Donald Trump was. Not unamusing. A womanizer of extraordinary proportions. That's our Donald. Mm.
Well, you quote, and I should say Steve Bannon is quoted quite a bit in your book, but this is on Trump's lawyer, Mark Cassowitz. Quote, Cassowitz on the campaign trail, we did have 100 women. Cassowitz took care of all of them. And now there's this story about this porn star who was paid $130,000 to, I guess, be quiet. Mm-hmm. How much should we believe what Steve Bannon says in your book?
Steve Bannon was obviously one of the people closest to the candidate and then the president. Steve Bannon has obviously has his own agenda, mm-hmm. but that agenda has been for a good part of the past year aligned with the president. So I think we should take Steve Bannon very seriously.
He, of course, is appearing before the Intelligence Committee today to talk about something that's in your book about this now infamous meeting that Donald Trump Jr. and Paul Manafort and others had with some Russian lawyer and some lobbyists in Trump Tower, June 2016. Why do you think, what happened? What did Steve Bannon, I guess, tell you happened at that meeting? And why do you think he's talking to the Intelligence Committee today?
Well, his version of that meeting was that Don Jr. was trying to impress his father in order to take over more authority in the campaign itself, and in fact to push out the campaign manager who was then Corey Lewandowski, and in order to do this. Steve's version, he had to bring something to his father, and this was an opportunity to do that. I've met with the Russians; they have dirt on Hillary Clinton, and I'm the man who got it. Therefore, you should give me more authority in the campaign.
In fact, Bannon is quoted as saying that Donald Jr. brought, I believe, the lawyer, maybe some of the others at that meeting, up to meet or believes.
He brought the whole crowd upstairs to meet his father.
Bannon's also quoted saying the Trump team is not capable of conspiring about anything, but also believing that this is essentially about money laundering, that that's what Mueller is looking at.
Yes, indeed.
Do you believe that?
I believe it's certainly a reasonable supposition. There's a passage in the book where I point out that there's a reason that people in the real estate business don't become the president of the United States, or actually don't even go into politics. Real estate, such as it is a business which requires spending a lot of time to be decorous about it in the gray areas, and when you're under a lot of scrutiny, that becomes extremely hard to defend. And Donald Trump is under a lot of scrutiny.
You described the firing of Comey essentially as a decision that the president made largely by himself, maybe with some input from Ivanka and Jared, but essentially a decision that he kept from the rest of his team. Also, one of the most consequential acts of a modern presidency.
I think the background of that seems to have been that he was encouraged to fire Comey by his daughter and son-in-law. Steve Bannon said at one point, when the president is worked up, it means someone is working him up. Mm-hmm. And so I think that there was a lot of stoking of this fire here. And and others, including Steve Bannon, including Reince Priebus, the chief of staff, were trying to convince him not to do this, and in fact had come to believe that they had convinced him that they had brought in a certain amount that they had convinced the president that this would backfire in a serious way, but nevertheless, suddenly on that day. Well, no one knew about this. I mean, the event happened at about 5 o'clock, prior to that, almost everybody was keeping their appointments. They had no idea. They just the president really decided on his own, sent the letter to Comey, and the deed was done without any advice from his staff.
And thus began the Mueller investigation, and on and on. That's Michael Wolff. His book is Fire and Fury Inside the Trump White House. Let me read some comments, several related to this point from Rob. Who in the White House provides control over Trump? Now we hear it's Kelly, who came really largely after your book is done, but who controls the president, or does anybody at this point?
Yeah, I mean, no, I think it's clear that no one controls the president. The president cannot be controlled, will not be controlled. Even to the extent that General Kelly has gained some control over the West Wing itself, right, he has not gained control over the president.
And you were not there when Kelly was there. Is that correct?
I was there a little bit.
A little.
I mean, I was still there. Kelly comes in at the end of August, and I was still doing reporting for this book right up until the middle of October.
Did John Kelly ask you what you were doing there in the White House?
Fortunately, he did not.
Fortunately, he did not. Well, interesting. An email from Gerald. It has been said that Mr. Trump watches an extraordinary amount of television. Did you encounter him at such moments or interview anyone who could confirm that habit?
Everybody knew this. I mean, everybody. It became a central way to get information to the president. You just had to feed it through certain television shows. But that's what the president does. That's how he gets his information. He watches television.
And you describe, really, I guess, unless there's some kind of an evening event, the president going to his bedroom with his hamburgers, cheeseburgers every night and watching television in bed?
You got it.
Like a lot of America, I guess.
Like a lot of America, I guess.
But is that a daily habit? And I ask that knowing, of course, he had his checkup, and we're going to hear from the doctor who gave him the checkup later today. He lives on hamburgers? Cheeseburgers?
Yes, he lives on hamburgers. And it's if not a daily habit. I mean, it's sometimes he actually has to work. That is the place that he apparently most wants to be at a given hour of the day, in bed watching television with his hamburger.
Let me ask you an email from Sydney. I had a similar question. I heard Mr. Wolf say he felt sorry that he brought Steve Bannon down as he liked him. Can you ask him what makes Bannon so likable, and will he stay down being such a forceful person? Michael Wolf?
He's smart. He's funny. He's full of insights. I doubt I agree with anything that Steve agrees with. But it was very revealing. Every minute I spent with Steve was a revealing minute. So I am grateful for the time that he gave me.
Do you feel you had a hand in bringing him down, though?
Well, I feel that Steve is probably not now where he wants to be or where he thought he would be. But I think if things had turned out differently, and specifically, I think Roy Moore in Alabama, if he had won, and that was Steve's candidate, mm-hmm. Steve would be a kingmaker now, and my book would have been part of his plan to break with Donald Trump, who honestly he thinks is an idiot.
He thinks the president is an idiot.
Yes, it's almost everybody thinks that is the truth.
But Steve Bannon supported Roy Moore. How smart is that?
Well, that turns out not to be very smart. But I think Steve Bannon could not have known, and nor could anyone else, that Roy Moore would be hoisted on the sexual harassment charges mm-hmm. that he was hoisted on. Other than that, it looked like as much of a sure shot as pretty much anything in politics can look like, the election of Roy Moore.
I saw a recent tweet of yours. It seems possible my book is helping push the president to a crack up. If so, what happens? I'll put that question to you. What happens? You quote people talking about the 25th Amendment.
I don't know. I mean, I think it's the existential question at the heart of American politics right now. I mean, the 25th Amendment exists, but nobody really knows how to use it. What do you do when you have a president who can't function in the office and whose abilities seem to lessen every day?
And when you went in, when you started this project, what was your opinion of Donald Trump?
I was open to the possibility that he would be that even being such a unusual figure and an aberrant figure, the opposite of what any other president is supposed to be, I was nevertheless open to the possibility that he might be a success.
Hmm. I want to play something from Saturday Night Live. You made it to Saturday Night Live on Saturday night. This is the opening. This actually opened with a Morning Joe skit. Willie Geist is played by Mikey Day, asking Michael Wolf, played by former SNL star Fred Armisen, about the book Fire and Fury.
Now, Michael, there's been several errors pointed out in this book already. Do you take responsibility for those?
Look, you read it, right?
Yeah. Yeah, of course.
And you liked it? You had fun? Well, what's the problem? You got the gist, so shut up. You know, even the stuff that's not true, it's true.
Can you laugh at that, Michael Wolf?
Hilariously.
I'm listening. You have to have a sense of humor.
All I've been doing is, yes, all I've been doing is laughing since the weekend.
Well, let me ask you about the weekend, because another thing that you said, you tweeted, was Trump has consistently made a distinction between immigrants from Western Europe and immigrants from other parts of the world and been puzzled why others would not see that logic.
Throughout his whole career of making public statements, that's been one of his themes. He goes around and he says, isn't anyone an American anymore? And this was pointed out to me, actually, that Trump's consistent statements about favoring European immigration over immigration from other parts of the world, this was pointed out to me by Richard Spencer, who was, I suppose, now the leading neo-Nazi in America.
Are you surprised your book is such a bestseller and so quickly?
Well, at the level that it is selling, yes, I am surprised.
And what are you going to do with all that money? Millions of dollars, I read.
I've read millions of dollars too. And
have you seen any of that yet?
Yes, no. I'm still, maxing out on credit cards.
Michael Wolff, thanks for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And the book is called Fire and Fury Inside the Trump White House. And I should add that he's speaking tonight at the Free Library of Philadelphia at 7:30. In fact, he'll be interviewed with, by my colleague, Dick Pullman. Do stay with us. We've got another guest waiting in the wings, talking more about race and politics, President Trump, and all of that. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. A week ago, everyone was talking about Oprah's uplifting speech at the Golden Globes, and some Democrats were fantasizing that this TV star could be their standard bearer and lead the party to victory. Now the conversation is about President Trump's vulgar and racially charged description of Haiti and the African continent, saying he prefer immigrants who come from Norway. There is some dispute about the words he used from members of Congress who were in the room at the White House at the time. But conservative blogger Eric Erickson tweeted that President Trump thought it would play well with his base. We asked Eddie Glaude Jr. to join us. He's chair of the Department of African American Studies and a professor of religion and African American Studies at Princeton University. Eddie Glaude Jr., nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
It's always a pleasure to talk with you.
Thank you very much. And to our listeners, you can send us a comment, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY. Radio Times. Are we having the right, the wrong conversation if we focus on this single word?
I think it's the wrong conversation. I think salty or spicy language happens behind closed doors in American life on a regular basis. I think the more important aspect of this conversation should be what was the content of the language. I think what was revealed in over the last few days is that there are racist assumptions driving immigration policy. That Donald Trump and others, like Stephen Miller and Senator Tom Cotton and Willie Perdue and Kevin McCarthy and others, are using immigration as a way of addressing what they see are significant demographic shifts in the country. In some ways, they are responding to a deep demographic anxiety that was evidenced in 2008 when, for the first time in the country's history, a president was elected without the majority of white people voting for him.
Well, you raised several interesting things. One is, and it was a question I had a little bit deeper into the interview, but do you think having a President Obama, the first African-American president, in a way led to President Trump?
I think that's Ta-Nehisi Coates' argument. I think we can begin to, there was a piece in The Atlantic just recently trying to show that the white backlash that Trump represents actually can be traced even further back to the backlash, the civil rights movement, to the war on poverty, to civil rights legislation from 64, 65, and of course the Fair Housing Act of 68. that Trump is the culmination of an attempt to undo the New Deal and the Great Society. And Barack Obama was this kind of moment that in some ways crystallized that energy. We saw immediately after his election the vitriol of the Tea Party. People were making the claim that it was principally economically driven, that it wasn't about race, but we knew that underneath it was this deep racial animus. And you combine the Tea Party with explicit efforts on the part of Republicans across the country to pass voter ID laws, to engage in voter suppression. So Trump is the result of a current of thinking in the country that is in some ways trying to resist what is inevitable. I like to think of this as the kind of last gasp of an understanding of America as white, male, and heterosexual.
Well, and now I'm seeing more and more people saying the president is a racist, and you talked about racist policies, and I think at this point we know starting from the birtherism to what happened, or allegedly what happened last week, is it helpful to say we have a racist president?
I think so. In this sense, I think it's important to identify the current that has been normalized, this political rhetoric, the ideas. There's a reason why, Richard Spencer and the folks in the Daily Stormer were claiming that the immigration policy was exactly about race. Mm-hmm. And if we don't name it as racism, we could call we can call white supremacists the alt-right, but we know what they are. It's just people who support white nationalism, and what else is that but racism? And we've always kind of linked the alt-right with Steve Bannon, and so Bannonism has underneath it this racist undertow, and Bannonism evidences itself in particular aspects of Trumpism. So I think as a certain kind of cultural warrior, Donald Trump is racist. As a certain kind of, when he traffics in that language, he's trafficking in racist stereotypes, he's trafficking in racist beliefs that exploit people's deepest fears. And we have to name it. And then once we name it, it's not just simply about saying you're a racist, therefore you're a bad person.
Mm-hmm.
It's about naming this is racist, and let's see how it's informing policy decisions. So I'll give you a quick example.
Sure, go ahead.
Rand Paul was on Meet the Press on this past Sunday, and he said if Donald Trump had said it would be better to accept immigrants, and I'm paraphrasing him here, to accept immigrants from resource-rich countries as opposed to resource-poor countries, he said there would not be much of an upheaval. And at that moment, what he revealed is that there was no difference between the argument Trump was making and that claim, which suggests to me not that Trump isn't racist, but that the claim itself is driven by racist assumptions that just simply go unspoken, you see. And so we need to kind of begin to unpack the ways in which racial dog whistles continue to inform Republican policies, and how Donald Trump has broken the norm by just simply using racial foghorns instead of whistles.
Well, interesting. And what we learned is people from Norway are not clamoring to come to the United States. That's a whole other thing, which actually I had a serious question related to that, which is perhaps this becomes this kind of perverse reality check on who we are. I know you and others have been trying to tell us who we are, but who we are as a nation, that we have a president who, call it what you want, who believes things that are hateful and discriminatory.
Yeah, I was, yesterday I was listening to Dr. King's speeches all day, and I do it every year as a kind of ritual to remind me of his wisdom and his sacrifice. And I was listening to a speech he delivered at Stanford in 1967. And he said he came to realize that the people in Montgomery, the people in Selma, were more in Birmingham. They were more offended by the violence of a Bull Connor or a Jim Clark than they were about the structure of segregation. They were more offended by the violence than they were about the structure. So it seems that a lot of people are more offended by the language of S-hole than they are about the racist underpinnings of immigration policy, of what just happened to the Garcia family, for example. And so I think what Trump has done, and just to answer your question directly, is he's let the genie out of the bottle. I've said over and over again that ever since I have come of political age, I've been immersed in racial dog whistle politics. From Ronald Reagan announcing his presidential campaign in Philadelphia, Mississippi, to George H.W. Bush and the Willie Horton advertisement, to Bill Clinton and Sister Soulja and Super Predators, right, to Barack Obama. And I mean, dog whistles have defined American political discourse. And here Donald Trump comes along, and instead of engaging in racial dog whistles, he's just George Wallace and Pat Buchanan. He just speaks it straightforwardly. So the genie's out of the bottle, and I guess what we have to decide as a country is whether it's wise to try to put it back in the bottle or to banish it altogether from our body politic. And I think the latter is the most the best option.
You have criticized, I remember being on the show, you criticized the Democratic Party for taking black voters for granted. I think you didn't even vote for, you didn't vote for Hillary Clinton. You didn't vote for Hillary Clinton because of your feelings about the Democratic Party and how it has viewed most black voters or perhaps even used them. And yet, you know, here we have Alabama where it looks as if black voters, particularly black women voters, were so significant in the election down there that turned a red state blue, at least temporarily.
Yeah, we have to think about what happened in Alabama and what happened in Virginia in a very nuanced way. The Democratic Party can claim it, but what we saw in both elections was extraordinary grassroots organizing, and the Democratic candidates benefited. But those grassroots organizers understood and understand what has to happen in 2018. There has to be a challenge to the Republican Party, to Donald Trump and Trumpism and the like, but it also has to be a challenge to corporate Democrats, to business as usual. And so the kind of organizing that we saw with Project South and other partners, with Black Vote and a range of other partners, suggest that the civil war that's going on in the Democratic Party is alive and well. People are making pragmatic and practical choices because we got to get Donald Trump and the Republicans out of office. But we also have to put forward a vision of what kind of country we want. It's not just simply we don't want Trumpism. We also have to put forward a vision of what genuine democracy will look like.
Do we want Oprah-ism?
Oh, no. No.
No, you say no. That was quick.
Yeah, no. You know, I mean, politics as entertainment is the problem. You know, when we view politics as entertainment, when people are tuning into the news as if it's bold and beautiful and the beautiful, you know, when we think that they're good guys and bad guys, and that melodrama defines the political process, what you wind up the result is you wind up having entertainers, real entertainers like Donald Trump show up. We don't need another billionaire entertainer to come in and solve our problems. What we need is a vibrant demos with thought. Not to say that Oprah Winfrey isn't thoughtful, but a vibrant demos with people with the skill set to address our institutional crisis, to address the crisis at the heart of the country. Not someone to come in and make us feel good about ourselves, but someone to help us to lead the way for us to figure out what the hell is going wrong and to put us on the right path.
What I hear from people who were all enthused was, save us. Oprah, save us.
Oh, my goodness.
I mean,
and she's been doing that for how long on television, right?
Right, get us a car or whatever, all those things that she gave away.
You know, the quick therapeutic fix. That's not what we need. We need something much more. We need something much bolder.
Eddie Glaude, you made it to Saturday Night Live.
Yeah, I was pretty. I was asleep.
Well, I'm going to play it for you, all right? This is during Saturday Night Live open, NBC's Joe Scarborough, played by Alex. I'm not sure what Alex's last name is. Interviews Eddie Glaude, that's you, played by Chris Redd. And let's give it a listen, and then we'll talk about it.
Let's get to the news. President Trump is at it again. He's using a deeply offensive word when describing Haiti and some African countries.
Can you just...
Joining me to break this down is chair for the Center for African American Studies at Princeton, Eddie Glaude. Eddie, this is a blatant example of inflammatory racist language. Why don't GOP leaders condemn this immediately? Well, first, because Eddie, you've studied this stuff extensively, okay? I mean, can you imagine any other president making comments like this? What's your take?
I mean, well,
I mean, this is not the first time that he said something like this. Is this a surprise given his comments in the past? He's talking about Haitians, he's talking about Africans. And the question is this: when will they get to speak? When is it their turn? How long will they be silenced?
I personally...
Eddie Glaude, great points. Thanks for joining us.
That was both funny but not funny, Eddie Glaude Jr.
Well, yeah, I was just on Morning Joe yesterday, and Joe tweeted afterwards, thank you for being on the show, and Eddie, you didn't let me get a word in edgewise. So, you know, it's funny, you know, as a country boy from Mississippi, to be parodied on Saturday Night Live is just amazing. And my mother and my father were tickled, to say the least. So,
do you worry for our country?
Every single day, every waking hour, you know, we are in deep crisis. And, you know, one of the things I've said before is we focus in on Trump, but Trump is just a symptom. He's, you know, the ecosystem of American democracy is in deep trouble. Congress, the House of Representatives, isn't a representative body because of gerrymandered districts. The basic norms of the Senate undermine Gorsuch. Regular order has been tossed to the trash bin. Everyday ordinary people distrust each other. We've moved into our partisan silos where we don't listen to each other anymore. No ideas of the public good have been hijacked as corporate elites rob the public coffers in a relentless pursuit of greed and money and power. Democracy is in trouble in this country. But each generation has to each generation has to reclaim democracy for itself. So we have a lot of work ahead of us. Yeah. So we have to roll up our sleeves and get to work.
You tweeted or said somewhere that Democrats should hold the line on DACA, meaning don't compromise, don't even a little wall or a piece of the wall, a clean DACA bill.
Clean DACA. Hold the line. And if they don't, if they compromise, then they will reveal once again that they lack the courage, the will, that they are in fact complicit. We need to be strong in this moment. I mean, the world saw yesterday the cruelty of this administration, that they would take a young man who's been here since he was 10 years old and separate him from his family in Detroit, to pull him away from his children, his two children and his wife. And we heard those tears. We heard that, I mean, they weren't crying, they were weeping. And they did it on MLK Day, the kind of callousness and cruelty. Democrats have to hold the line. If they don't, then they're part of the problem.
Even though, I mean, this is rough politics. We're almost out of time here. But, you know, if there's no compromise, if there is no DACA, there are going to be more of those families ripped apart.
Yeah, but we have to. Well, we hope not, but we have to hold the line. They have the leverage, that unimaginable leverage right now. Use it. Be bold.
Eddie Glaude Jr., thank you for joining us today in Radio Times.
Always a pleasure. You take care.
You too. And he's chair of the Department of African American Studies, also professor of religion and African American studies at Princeton University. And we began our conversation with Michael Wolff, author of Fire and Fury Inside the Trump White House. And again, he's going to be interviewed tonight at the Free Library of Philadelphia by WHYY's Dick Pullman. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Trinae Nuri. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thank you for joining us.